We've got a big deal in big oil to tell you about on a day which, not coincidentally, crude prices dropped 6%. We've got the latest in drought economics and also what to wear at the office. A very, very simple solution. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In New York, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday, the 8th day of April. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. You know, we have talked for years on this program about big oil, the idea that a relative handful of companies control a huge part of a vital market. Well, today brings us a new moniker. Welcome to the age of tough oil, the idea that with prices low and drilling costs high, it is only going to get tougher out there to make a buck. Thus, the announcement this morning that Royal Dutch Shell is going to spend $70 billion, to buy Britain's BG Group. It's the biggest energy merger in about 17 years and may be a harbinger of many, many more to come. Marketplace's Gigi Duban starts us off.
Shell paid a lot for BG, but Nikos Saffos, a partner at Analytica, says it's worth every penny.
BG is very big in Tanzania, so Shell basically now becomes the dominant player in Tanzania, and that's a great platform for doing exports into Asia.
But this merger isn't just about building business. It's also a reaction to big changes in the oil and gas sector. Bill Arnold teaches energy management at Rice University. He says this merger is Shell's chance to regain momentum.
Their operations in North America last year were not profitable.
Shell and BG were caught off guard by the slump in oil prices, but they weren't the only ones. Stephen Kopitz is managing director of Princeton Energy Advisors. He says everyone in the industry has taken a hit.
These guys have to find ways to cut costs. They have to find ways to specialize even at that large level.
Kopitz says companies are making less money from oil production, but at the same time, many of them still have lots of expensive projects in the pipeline.
Oil prices are not really coming back and may not come back for a little bit yet to levels that work for those companies.
Oil field service providers are particularly affected. Rice University's Arnold says everyone from equipment suppliers to drilling service companies have been squeezed.
They've been under a lot of pressure from their clients to reduce costs, reduce prices for their services and so forth.
He says as these companies try to drive down costs, we can expect to see more mergers. I'm Gigi Duban for Marketplace.
The Prime Minister of Greece, Alexis Tsipras, is in Moscow today chit-chatting with Russian President Vladimir Putin. The common thread between the two men and their countries? A distinctly uneasy relationship with the European Union. From the European desk in London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard has that story.
President Putin spoke today of the shared spiritual roots between Russia and Greece. Both countries have Orthodox Christian churches, but Russia analyst John Luff says Putin doesn't really have religion in mind, but something else.
To put pressure on the unity of the European Union.
Putin wants to snag at least one no vote when the EU states meet this summer to consider renewing sanctions against Russia. Sanctions have to be approved unanimously. Athenian blogger John Serapalis says Greece is running out of money fast and it's open to offers.
This might perhaps allow Mr. Putin to give the Greeks a bundle of goodies that will prize them out of the European United Front on the issue of sanctions.
A bundle of cash might do the trick, like the $23 billion Greece needs to pay its debts this year. That used to be loose change for the Kremlin, but, says John Luff, not anymore.
Russia is not in a position to extend large amounts of largesse at the moment because of its own economic problems.
Like sanctions and falling oil prices, but if Russian cash is not available, there is some lower hanging fruit for the Greeks to grab.
Nectarines and peaches and kiwi fruit.
That's the kind of produce that Greece used to export to Russia until Putin banned a whole range of EU foodstuffs. Getting him to lift the embargo on Greece would help a bit.
That would mean $1 billion worth of Greek exports.
But this is a trifle, say the Germans, and look at what the Greeks are risking. Playing footsie with Putin, they're putting their whole relationship with the Western world in jeopardy. Heinz Schulte is a leading German commentator.
what is it that Russia can offer to Greece that will compensate for falling out completely with Europe at large and the United States.
But in Athens, John Serapalis says after 6 years of economic misery, Greeks no longer seem to care about upsetting their Western partners.
There's no feeling that in this marriage between Greece and the West, there's a danger of breaking the wedding china, because the wedding china's already been broken.
Critics say Greece is in a plate-smashing frenzy, which may just end in divorce and the country's ejection from the Eurozone. At the European Desk, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
There was a little bouncing around in equities today, but all's well that ends well, I guess. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Figuring out what to wear at the office every day seems, on the face of it, easy, but it is, in reality, what's known as a multivariable problem. Do you have an important meeting? Are you making a presentation to a client? What is the weather going to be? So 3 years ago, Matilda Call decided she wasn't going to do that anymore. She wasn't going to waste the time and the mental energy anymore. She started wearing the same thing to work every single day. She wrote about it for Harper's Bazaar this week, so we asked her to come on and talk about it with us. Matilda, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Tell me how this came to pass, this uniform, I guess, that you wear.
Well, it all started one morning when I had a very important meeting coming up. And I started to, you know, throw on and off different clothing pieces. But nothing seemed to work. You know, you end up looking like some kind of clothing hurricane. And I ultimately threw on something that I immediately regretted on the subway, per usual. And I get to the office, and when I get there, I'm not only late, but I'm unprepared, and I wear something that makes me look like a maniac.
And this is all because you couldn't decide what to wear in the morning?
Yeah. It sounds easy to just throw on something, but there's more to it than that. We have a lot of skilled women at the office, always looking super neat.
And there is pressure, right?
Exactly. Yeah. They're super fashionable. Some ladies even, you know, wear high heels every day, you know, fixed hair, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. It's New York after all.
Yeah.
And I just stood there. I'm like, you know what? I'm just going to opt out of this.
You do imagine, I guess, a bit of thinking about this, and you land on a white blouse and a black pair of pants.
You know, the simplicity, it was the main point of the whole thing from the beginning.
Yeah.
I shopped it all in one day. No problem.
I read an article, and this will make sense in a minute, about President Obama and how he basically, and politicians generally, always wear dark suit, white shirt, red tie.
Yeah.
Because it gives them one less thing to think about in the morning. So you're freeing your brain up for other stuff.
It makes sense. I must say here, this doesn't mean that I don't love to dress. I go crazy over the weekends. I simply just choose to put this choice and time and love for clothing at nights and during weekends instead, when I actually, you know, feel like I enjoy it.
How long did it take for your coworkers? And we should say you're an art director or on the art staff at a mm-hmm. creative advertising agency,
See.
Right? So you're around people who notice this kind of stuff in
Correct.
Theory. How long did it take them to notice that it was white shirt and black pants for you every single day?
Well, it's funny. It took some time for people to actually approach me about it.
Huh.
I don't know why, but it was definitely not something that people just jumped over me and was like, hang on, you've been at the same
Yeah, you wear the same clothes, mm-hmm. It's been 3 years now,
mm-hmm.
right? Any sign that this is going to change anytime soon, or are you done? This is it now and for the foreseeable future?
Well, I see it like this. I wouldn't have any problem with giving it up if I felt like it, but it works great for me. So, yeah, I have no plans of stopping.
Has anything actually changed?
My life has just become so much more efficient in so many ways. And it's this funny thing. My ex-VP at the agency mm-hmm. where I used to work, the first couple of weeks when I wore the outfit, she came to another colleague and she was like, Man, I feel so bad. We don't pay Matilda enough. She can't afford clothing. We have to give her a salary bump. This is just not working. Unfortunately, that never happened. But maybe I should use it as an argument.
Matilda Kolff, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Coming up.
With the right people and the right story, you know, you can have a diverse cast without calling attention to the fact that you have a diverse cast.
That plus crazy car stunts gets you a box office blockbuster. That's straight ahead. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is up 27 points, about a 10%, closed at 17,902 today. The NASDAQ up 40 points, 0.8%, ended things at 49.50. The S&P 500 gained 5 points, 0.25%, finished at 2,081. We told you earlier about Royal Dutch Shell agreeing to buy the British oil and gas producer BG Group. Shell off 4%. Today, BG bumped up 26.75%. Generic drug maker Mylan surged 14.75%. Wants to buy rival pharma firm Perrigo for $29 billion in cash and stock. If that deal goes through, the combined company will be one of the world's biggest sellers of generic and over-the-counter medicines, by the by. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on wholesale inventories and sales for February. Golfers tee off in Augusta, Georgia during the first round of the Masters Tournament. And have you ever wished you had a different name? Tomorrow is Name Your...
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Gusto. Let your employees know you've got their back by signing up for Gusto for payroll and HR. More than 300,000 small business owners use Gusto. They offer benefits like health insurance, employee onboarding, and more. Get your payroll taxes filed, deductions calculated, and your team paid fast. No more pain. Just the joy of running your business. Get 3 months free when you go to gusto.com/marketplace. That's gusto.com/marketplace.
Self Day. So take the initiative to introduce yourself with some fabulous name. Might I suggest Michelle? Because I'll be calling myself Beatrice for a day. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. A lot of you have probably heard the headline drought-related water number from out in California that farmers and ranchers use 80% of the state's water while contributing less than 2% of California's total economic output. Governor Jerry Brown, he of the mandatory 25% cuts in non-agricultural water use in California, has been defending the ag industry this past week, saying many farmers have already seen their irrigation water cut back, especially the ones in the Central Valley, who depend so much on snowmelt from the Sierra Nevada. So from our sustainability desk, Marketplace's Sarah Gardner explains exactly what those farmers are growing with the diminished water supply that they have and who's buying it.
Rule number one in farming, it's a business. That's what Jay Lund at the University of California, Davis reminded me a few months back.
And so when a farmer is short on water, they're going to say, well, I'd like to have more water, but the water I have, I'm going to make the most profit from it that I can.
That's why farmers in the Central Valley use their water to grow high-value specialty crops, says Bill Matthews at the University of California's Agricultural Issues Center.
Well, the specialty crops, you know, would include your fruits and nuts and vegetable crops and anything that would not be a staple crop.
Actually, if you take the top six crops by acreage grown in the valley and made dinner, you'd have a big bunch of grapes and almonds on one side of the plate, a walnut pistachio mix in the center, and a helping of rice topped with canned tomatoes. Most of the nut crop, by the way, is sold overseas. Jonas Minton is water policy advisor to the Planning and Conservation League. He says California shouldn't tell farmers what they can grow, but...
It does not make sense to plant more of these permanent crops that require water in wet years and in dry years at the same time that our cities are having to cut back so much.
For right now, though, the numbers still pencil out for lucrative tree crops like almonds, even with growers paying steeper water prices and digging expensive wells to stay in business. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
15 minutes of exercise could save you 15% on your life insurance. John Hancock Financial said today that it's going to offer discounts to policyholders who wear wireless fitness trackers. And then, and here's a warning, possible deal-breaking caveat ahead, share that data with the company. But this thing is not just about customers living longer. It's also about giving a youthful glow to the aging and perhaps ailing life insurance industry itself. From WBUR in Boston, Kurt Nickisch explains.
Sign up for a new life policy today, and John Hancock will send you a Fitbit. You know, one of those bracelets that tracks your steps. The more exercise you get, the bigger discount you get on your insurance premium. Company president Craig Bromley says the company will also reward good behavior with things like iTunes gift cards, discounted hotel stays, and movie passes.
It's great to be at sort of the forefront of all this technological change, which, you know, hasn't always been the case for the life insurance industry.
No, it hasn't. A recent report from PricewaterhouseCoopers says the life insurance industry has been kind of dead. The number of policies today has barely gone up from 1950, even though the population has grown. Bromley hopes the new program will lure new people in.
You know, we would like them to buy our product. You know, that would be certainly good for us, but also good for them.
The question is, will this work? Tim LePain is a certified financial planner.
People need life insurance.
He says in the past, life insurance wasn't just seen as a death benefit. It was also an investment that would pay out even if you lived for a long time. Nowadays, it's a tougher sell.
It's less prevalent today because there are many other ways to invest your money.
Like mutual funds. That's made the life insurance industry ripe for reinvention, and analysts expect more companies to follow John Hancock's lead. In Boston, I'm Kurt Nickisch for Marketplace.
We've been running a series the past week or two about Germany and the way it handles higher education. For one thing, the state pays, so there is no student debt over there. For another, Germany's got an apprenticeship program that gets students ready for technical jobs, jobs that pay well, jobs that fill a need in society, but jobs that don't require 4 years of college. Part of what makes all that possible, though, is a system they have over there that tracks students from a young age, too, down one academic path or another. Kirk Carapeza from WGBH wraps up our series.
At an elementary school in Essen, students stream in from recess. They stuff boots into cubbies and hang up their jackets. This fourth grade classroom looks a lot like classrooms in American public schools. Martin, do you mind if I ask you some questions? What are you working on here? It looks like you guys are working on a project about the history of the bicycle.
This isn't the erste Tag.
Martin's class includes students at all levels, but next year, that will change. That's when Martin and his classmates will be placed into three very different tracks. One is a path to college, the second leads to an apprenticeship in a trade, the third path could lead students in either direction. Have you started to think about what you want to be when you get older?
Ja, ich möchte Taucher werden.
Bela says he wants to be a deep-sea research scientist. That means he'll want to go to college. Germany is selective about who goes, since there are fewer spots and college is free. The state picks up the tab. In Germany, it's on teachers to identify which students are likely to be college material, and the process begins early. Principal Liz Vincent says that puts a lot of pressure on teachers, who have to make tough calls with anxious parents looking on.
They just had their midterm grades last week, and it only took 3 hours for the first parents to complain, because parents feel very pressured to have their kids be college bound.
What do you think of the current system? Is it effective?
No, it's better for the children if they learn together for a longer period of time, because the sorting really isn't helping much.
Vincent's taught students who were put on the lowest track. She questions whether full potential can be predicted so early on. She also says students on the lowest track are disproportionately poor or children of immigrants.
Any form of tracking is a form of discrimination, really. Even if you don't tell that to the children, they're feeling it.
Supporters of tracking point to Germany's vocational system, where students who don't go to college are given the opportunity to learn a trade and can still make good money. Joshua Hallett is an American expat and a pilot for FedEx. He and his wife Wendy live in Dusseldorf, an affluent city north of Cologne. They have two teenage sons who are on the university track.
If I look at it from an analytical standpoint as opposed to my child is involved in it, what I see is a system that yields students that are normally falling through the cracks or think they're going to the university because that's the only option.
His wife, Wendy, thinks the system has benefited their kids.
I love it.
Her sons are high-achieving students, and Wendy says they benefit from learning with other kids tracked for college.
They are taught at a level that they understand and where they can perform.
The subject matter doesn't necessarily differ from track to track, but the depth and pace of teaching does. And Joshua says Americans would be quick to call that unfair.
And the tracking system in Germany is, for lack of a better word, it's so un-American because it doesn't give you that golden ring to reach for. And Americans are bred from an early age that nobody can tell you what to do, but you can do what you want.
The irony is that the American system was partially a reaction to Germany's approach. In the 1950s, former Harvard president James Brian Conant served as ambassador to Germany. He didn't like what he saw there, so he came home and led a movement to reform American schools.
I believe our system of public education is one of the unique features of the society we have developed on this continent.
It took 30 years, but by the 1980s, any type of tracking in the U.S., even within high schools, was widely considered regressive and unjust. But in Germany, the system hasn't changed much in 60 years, even though parents like Anya Turner worry about its effect on their children.
My daughter is maybe not as focused as we want her to be sometimes. I would find it very sad for her to set that path after the fourth grade.
Turner's daughter is 9. If she isn't placed on a track to university, Anya could decide to ignore the recommendation. The government recently granted parents the right to make that choice. But ignoring a recommendation is rare, because for all their misgivings, Germans still trust the system. In Essen, Germany, I'm Kirk Carapeza for Marketplace.
You can check out the whole series on how Germany does higher ed. It's online at marketplace.org. You know, $161 million ain't bad for less than a week's work. You pile another $250 million-ish on top of that for overseas box office. And Furious 7, yes, the seventh installment of the Fast and Furious franchise, is, you might say, off and running. That is despite the death of star Paul Walker a year and a half ago and Universal's digital efforts to keep his character alive in the film. Wesley Morris writes on movies for Grantland. Wesley, good to talk to you again.
Nice to see you. Welcome to New York.
I know. We're in a different place. Furious 7.
Oh, my God.
So, first of all, have you seen it? Because it's not my cup of tea.
I've seen it.
And?
I think it's great. I love it. As you know, I love these movies. We've had this conversation at least one other time. They're so much better made than they even need to be at this point.
Yeah.
And that is part of the pleasure in watching them.
Is it not a tad ghoulish, though? With Paul Walker no longer being with us and them having sort of redigitized him and you know, all that kind of stuff.
Okay, three things. The number one is I can't tell where the digital trickery comes in and the actual Paul Walker ends.
Fair enough. Thing two.
Thing two is I think the movie does a really good job of treating his relationship to this series in as credible a way that is in no way ghoulish, actually. Uh-huh. There's a montage at the end.
Right. They do a little tribute.
But it's sort of extra narrative, if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. It has nothing to do with the plot. But the audience knows what the montage is about.
Oh, got
it. For the environment of these films, it is actually pointing towards something more optimistic. Hmm. And then the third thing is I think it actually turns into a celebration of Paul Walker.
Fair enough.
In his relationship to these movies, too. He's in the whole movie. So there's a surreal continuity to what actually happened to him.
Interesting.
And Brian O'Connor, who is the character he plays in these movies. I think it's very deftly and very tastefully done.
Fair enough. The numbers on this thing are bananas.
Yes.
Making money hand over fist.
Yes.
I wonder if, and this is something you and I have talked about in the past, part of the reason they are making so much money is that the cast is so diverse and thus the audience, the potential audience for this film is also diverse and thus bigger.
I think that is definitely a huge part of it, at least in North America.
Yeah.
I think the number is 75% non-white, the audience. I find that really exciting.
Yeah.
I'm curious to see how the film industry responds to this. Now, this is the seventh of these movies.
Right.
And the lineup of these movies hasn't changed too much. They've always been predominantly brown. I mean, I think people think that Universal has the multiracial, multi-ethnic thing locked up, right?
Yeah.
I think they have the Fast and Furious thing locked up. I don't think it's that people only want to see brown people drive cars and you
right.
know.
There's the pull quote
and,
right
and
there.
And rob banks.
Yeah.
It, with the right people and the right story, you know, you can have a diverse cast without calling attention to the fact that you
that
have
a diverse cast.
Right.
A word here about the franchiseness of this thing. Universal yes. is obviously sitting pretty with this one, but they have not had a lot of success with franchises.
Yeah, I don't know whether this one even continues. I mean, I'm curious to know how many more of these movies they make.
Can I go see this one without having seen 1 through 6?
Oh, my God. Can you understand cars going backwards out of flying objects?
Yes, I can.
And, like, landing via parachute on roads in the Caucasus? I think you can get it.
All right. Wesley Mars, he writes on films for Grantland. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
This final note on the way out today, in which ESPN doubles as the Grinch. 12-year-old Sam Holtz of Hawthorne Woods, Illinois, tied for first place in ESPN's March Madness basketball bracket. That is tied for first out of 11.5 million brackets. And yet, he is not, Sam won't, be allowed to enter the lottery for a $20,000 gift certificate or a trip to Hawaii because the rules say you had to be 18 to enter. About which, fine, but then an ESPN spokesman said this, quote, "The great thing is that this kid beat all those experts out there. That's what makes this so awesome. The prize really is secondary," end quote. No, ESPN, no, it's not. I mean, come on. You got to give the kid a chance to win, right? All right, we're out of here. The Dow up 27 points today, about a 10%. The NASDAQ up 40 points, 0.8%. The S&P 500 gained 5 points. That is a 0.25%. Robbie Carman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Jake Gorski, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Michael Rayfield, and Charlton Thorpe engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. And this is APM.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.